Introduce yourself, please.
Susan Weigel, state senator, actually Senate president from Wichita, Kansas.
We have an enormous number of questions for you today, but first we're going to hear the open. This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. Joining Susan and me in the KCUR 89.3 Topeka studios today is my Kansas News Service colleague, Jim McLean. Jim, thanks for being here.
Welcome, and it's good to host you guys.
Lots and lots and lots to cover with the Kansas Senate president, but before we get deep into that, I want an update on your seven kids, and if I'm not mistaken, 14 grandkids. I don't know that we
Close,
can cover 13, all of them.
13
yeah. I don't know that we can cover all of them, but give me a couple of highlights.
Well, My daughter has been fighting multiple myeloma. She's in remission, and she lives in Lawrence, has four children, and she hasn't gone back to work yet, but we're very thankful that she's in a new trial that's working well for everybody that's a multiple myeloma patient. So they're doing
news.
Well. Kids are having fun. They're in school, and we can't wait till it's spring and we can swim and be together again.
Good. We have to cover the budget today, taxes, transportation, some Medicaid expansion. But with Jim's kind permission, I'm going to go ahead and take the first question and ask for your reaction this week about the possibility that Governor Brownback may be headed off to Rome with the rank of ambassador. What do you think that means for this session in Kansas going forward?
Sam, we've heard that specific rumor for a long time now. And we'd be happy for him if he were nominated for that position. I'm sure the U.S. Senate would confirm him. He has some very excellent relationships there in the U.S. Senate. But right now, we're all focused on the shortfall and on a budget solution.
I want to just take one more question there. You've had a testy relationship with Governor Brownback, especially over budget and taxes. Do you think that you would that the session would go smoother, or that your job would be a little bit easier with Governor Collier as opposed to Governor Brownback?
Well, I've served with Lieutenant Governor Collier in the Kansas Senate, and we don't know yet. We don't know if his policies would differ from the current governor's, if he would offer us a new path out of the hole that we're experiencing. We can't tell if he'd come in with a new plan. Certainly after we had the veto, the veto was sustained on the last tax plan. We asked, the leadership of both the House and the Senate, asked the governor for a new plan, and we haven't received one yet. We'd like to see some fresh ideas, and if we get a new governor, we'll ask the new governor for his plan.
Jim, jump on in here.
Well, you know, and I understand why everybody is being cautious at this point, and Senator President is correct. These rumors about Governor Brownback have been around for a long time now, ever since the election. And yet, when reporters talked to him yesterday, he essentially wouldn't confirm that he would be here to the end of the session. And he and Governor Collier, frankly, had, you know, they were kind of smiling and grinning, and it does appear for all the world, I think there's some good sources behind this story, this is really just a matter of timing. And perhaps even given the fact that he'd have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate and everything else, maybe it won't move that quickly and make any difference at all to this session. But it's got to be something that you guys are talking about behind the scenes as leadership, right?
Well, certainly we're talking about it, but I think that both the House and the Senate, we feel a great burden mm-hmm. that we need to move forward no matter what happens on the second floor and fix this budget deficit. So we would love to have a partner. As you already know, we put the governor's tax plan on the floor of the Senate this week, and it only had one vote. And that was from a Democrat who had put an amendment in the bill. So we are willing to partner and work through a solution and, you know, grind through it and talk about possible changes to that solution. But right now, I think that the House Speaker and I feel like the burden is on us to fix the problem.
So what is the actual sticking point now? Is it the balance between raising additional revenue through tax increases. And I know that you and a couple of others would like to see more spending cuts in that arrangement. Is that where the disconnect is at the moment, the balance between tax increases and spending cuts? Is that what's holding things up?
I see us, Jim, as making some very great progress. But Jim, you've been involved in the legislature for many, many years. You know how when we start out a session in the Kansas Senate, I have 40 different opinions about how to close that gap. And in the House, there's 125 different opinions. So we're all sharing our opinions and working with each other, but we have not coalesced yet around a solution.
Okay.
Coalesced, though. We had the Majority Leader, Jim Denning. We were fortunate to have him last week. He seems to think that everybody's come to agree that there's a $450 million figure. The question now is how you get there. So you agree with that?
Absolutely. And Jim is very good at financing. He's very bright on that. And as he stated last week, the House, the Senate, and the governor all agree that that is our deficit.
I want to go back to something you said just a moment ago before we move on to some other issues, and that is the partnership with the governor. Do you feel at this moment that you don't have a partnership with the governor, that he is AWOL, that he is not fully participating in this process?
Well, he knows that we're not going to fall for a one-time solution of borrowed money and selling an asset because we look at the out years. His term is up, and we have a new governor in 2020. And clearly, if we sell our assets and borrow money to get through this year and the next 2 years, we fall off the cliff in 2020 with a new governor. We're not willing to pass the buck. We want a structural fix, and we don't see any solutions coming from his office.
And just, I mean, Sam, I think you and the Senate President said that everybody seems to agree that there's this $450 million target that we're shooting for in terms of, you know, the amount of revenue that needs to be raised to create a structural fix for the budget problems. But I don't know if you saw Dwayne Gosin's most recent columns, but he says that's not nearly enough going into the out years, that you're going to need more than that, particularly with the school finance decision. I know that you're trying to separate those issues to some extent, but really, is that $450 million figure, is there true consensus around that number?
I think there is true consensus. And I do understand that Dwayne would like to see a much larger tax increase. However, Kansas is a very conservative state, and we're also a centrist type state. And I was in a meeting yesterday and with a number of senators, asking them what direction they want to go. And Senator Estes, a new senator from Western Kansas who came over from the House, he said, look, we went way too far to the right on the tax plan in 2012. You know, we all thought we'd come back and fix it. We knew it wasn't what we wanted. And he said, look, we can't go too far to the left in fixing this because Kansans do not want a giant tax increase. They do not want to pay those bills. I believe Kansans want a solution similar to a solution they would arrive at if their family finances took a dip. I believe that we need to cut. Obviously, to get through this year, we're going to have to borrow and we're going to have to tax. And I think that is a well-balanced solution.
Senator Denning also said last week that looking at fiscal 2018, that he may be asking public school districts to dip in up to 2% of their reserves to help what he's calling a bridge year, to get us into a really structurally balanced budget. Where are you on asking school districts to dip into their reserves at any amount?
Well, we started that conversation with schools in January. When we came in, we knew we were out of balance. And Senator McGinn, our chair of the Budget Committee, and I, and a number of legislators have been talking to their school districts, and we've said, hey, are you willing to take that cut now so that we can write a new school finance formula and so that we can give you back the money and bring stability to your financial environment? The schools feel just as insecure as our agencies do right now. We all know that 18 is going to be a very tough year. The question is, and we had a lot of school districts say, yes, I will take that cut. I will use my reserves. Susan, I need stability and predictability as soon as you can get it to me. So there are a number of schools that want to participate in that. That's the direction the Senate was going, and then the Gannon decision came down last week. So,
well, then let's just go with that and ask, how does that complicate your life?
You know, I was here for Montoy. Yep. And I don't...
That was a school finance lawsuit previous to Gannon. Right.
Yes. And the court was very specific in Montoy. And I sense a very different tune, even though we have a lot of the same people in the Gannon decision, in that, you know, Kansas is experiencing an agricultural recession, a huge downturn in receipts, an unexpected downturn, and the court... The court has said that we're not whole till you give us another $20 million. And their employees, they've had to change their work schedules, their dockets. It's taking a long time to arrive at their dockets. Even the court is short of money. And so I feel like in this decision, they didn't tell us that a specific amount of money is what they need to make the system whole. And in fact, the decision said that 75% of your students are meeting Rose standards. They're doing well. What the court is concerned about is that group of at-risk students. How do we meet their needs? I felt like the tone in this decision was totally different than Montoy. Because they're short of, I think they are experiencing the shortfall just like the rest of state government-funded agencies are feeling the shortfall.
But you don't really believe that you can... meet constitutional muster by not putting any new money into schools to solve this adequacy problem.
No.
What you're saying is that you don't think it may not be $800 million,
it may not be $500
million.
What this court is requiring is that we look at how to take care of that very specific population. I'm a former school teacher. I taught emotionally disturbed kids. They were at risk. They were from one-parent homes. Fifth and sixth grade, most of them could not read. And as soon as I was able to teach them to read, many of them became much more functional in the classroom. They're asking us to take that one group of kids and help them excel, help them to learn how to read, help them to learn math. And we're going to look at the outcomes. And it's almost an intervention in the home that helps you be successful in dealing with that risk. You have to get the kids into the classroom. Some of them don't come on a daily basis. You know, some of them are hungry. And it's a whole different problem I think the court has challenged us with than they challenged in Montoy. They did not say all students are underfunded. They said this group of kids are not meeting the Rose standards.
It sounds like you're talking about an awful lot of things that some people would consider somewhat tangential to a school finance formula. And I think Senator Denning also made the point that we're not going to go back to the old weighting mechanisms. So it sounds like you're talking about some very, very different kinds of approaches to solving this specific problem that the court has pointed out.
Absolutely. We have a great model for at-risk kids in the Head Start program, which is a federal program, and interventions with very young children to get them ready for school, and then the program called Follow Through that takes that specific group of kids that is also Head Start. I worked with that program in the 80s. They taught teachers how to visit homes, make sure the kids were coming to schools, how to get the resources to that single parent that they needed to get the kids to schools, and they taught them special teaching skills for reading and math. It is that at-risk student doesn't have the advantage of going home and having mom and dad say, it's time to do homework, turn off the television, and let me help you with it. It's a whole different problem. And that's what the court's focusing on, and obviously, I think it's going to take time to determine if the legislature has met the needs of those students because it's going to be over testing over a period of years. But, you know, the at-risk kids are the group that are failing, and those are the kids we want to lift up in our society and the families that we want to work with. And it does take a lot more intervention in the home life.
Well, let's just go with this for a second. I need to ask, so what's your solution to that? It sounds to me like it's not so much a school funding formula, but it is going to take more time and more money to help to reach out to these kids, whether that's in a school funding formula or you put more money into other programs to help people with parenting skills or food or health care, whatever that is. So what, you know, in your perfect world, how do you fix that?
Well, first of all, I did appoint a new school finance committee that was very geographically diverse, right. That was diverse in the way they approached problem solving.
And I might, I think it had a lot of education expertise on it,
yes,
as I looked at the members.
So, and I feel like they're going to come up with some specific solutions. But, you know, some people think the at-risk kids are in the city of Wichita and in Wyandotte County. But the truth of the matter is we have a lot of at-risk children who do not speak English out in western Kansas. So it's a problem statewide. And I've delegated that to a committee, a very bright committee, and I'm going to be looking forward to their hearings and seeing how they address the problem.
But I need you to, you will say yes or no, this is going to take more money. Whether that goes into a school funding formula or gets spread out through other departments, you have to say that it's going to take more money.
It does
take
more money.
We just don't know how much.
To intervene with that population. So the first thing I did was I called my staff and I said, I want to see if we're making use of all the federal funding we can pull down for this special group of kids. So we're researching that right now because even the federal government recognizes that states need assistance with this population. So we're looking to see if we've made adequate use of the federal programs. And I believe, as I stated earlier, the court... It was a reasonable judgment, and I think it was a reasonable thing to say, help us, let's get these kids to start to succeed. But I think the court, with their experience with our finances, they know we're going to have to grow into this solution. You know, we did a tax plan on the floor, the House overrode it, and there was a lot of concern in the Senate about that tax plan being retroactive to January of this year and everybody getting a big bump in their checks right now. And a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck. I do not believe we can pass a retroactive tax. I think we're going to have to grow we need a structural balance. We have to grow. And we have to put that structure in place for those at-risk kids, but we're going to have to grow into financing it because I can't backdate a tax. It's just not right to do that to Kansans.
And just moving on real quickly, because Sam, I think billboarded this at the top of of our conversation, because it's also a budgetary issue, and it's not gotten a lot of discussion recently, but recently a couple of gas tax bills were introduced, one in the House, one in the Senate, one for 5 cents, one for 11 cents a gallon, and obviously the transportation lobby is looking for some way to restore funding to KDOT. You know, we often refer to the bank of KDOT money. It's been taken year after year after year to shore up the state general fund. And it doesn't look like you're going to be able to provide much help to KDOT until about 2020, given the budget situation. And so there's a little bit of a disconnect, even in the transportation community, between how best to raise funds. The gas taxes, I'm curious as to whether you think they have any chance at all of passing, because I think the reason people like that is because it's statutorily, it can go nowhere else but the highway fund. But right now, KDOT is getting a percentage of a state sales tax, but that money has been taken year after year. And so some other folks are asking for additional bonding authority to help KDOT do just basic maintenance. Which of those approaches do you think will prevail, if either one?
I think there's a lot of concern about the debt that we've taken on the last few years. I don't see bonding. You know, the unusual thing is I started thinking through all this last night because that gas tax was just introduced in the Senate.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is this governor likes consumption tax. And so I didn't look at the rate that was proposed in that bill that went to the tax committee. I think it has a hearing next week. But I'm thinking that, and I haven't asked the governor because it was just introduced, he is clearly more pro-consumption tax than he is income tax. So that may not take a veto override to pass.
Yeah, but you talked about about approximately a third of the legislature who's brand new to the process, and I don't know if they're as pro-consumption tax as the people they replaced and or the governor. So it sounds like you think that might be something that isn't dead on arrival, though, the gas tax proposal.
No, I don't think that's dead on arrival. It's a consumption tax. And he would rather lean on consumption, and of course, if we could when you pass a tax specifically from consumption on gasoline, it goes, they can't use that for anything but roads. So that could pull some sales tax back into the budget that's failing right now. And I thought, you know, that might be a tax that only takes 21 and 63 and doesn't take a veto override.
I know Jim wants to get to Medicaid expansion because Jim wants to get to Medicaid expansion. But I want to just stick with KDOT just for a second. And in a bigger, broader sense, if you follow the governor's office tweets, and I know that you're new to the Twitter, that they suggest that the Kansas roads essentially paved with platinum. Everything is fine. And I'm wondering if you think that KDOT can continue to withstand sweeps and have maintenance deferred. Where are you on that?
Well, I think the roads are in very good shape. But I think that the legislature wants a structural fix that also puts money back in roads for growth. You know, hey, look what's happened to the stock market since Trump was elected. We need to be poised for growth. And part of the growth package is transportation. Hopefully, if the Trump administration comes in with a plan for building, we'll participate in that. But I think we're in good shape now. But we can't continue to do this in the future. No, we want money back in transportation, and that puts people back to work too. So we need to find a way to fix this. We need to quit borrowing money from fee funds and KDOT and you know, selling assets and borrowing to pay the bills.
Jim?
Do I have your permission now, Sam, to move on to? Well, the reason I wanted to particularly
I'm on the edge of my seat, Jim.
Well, are you really? The reason I really wanted to talk to Senator Wagle about this is because I know what I've heard is year after year when I talk to Tom Bell at the Hospital Association and others who are pushing this expansion bill, they tell me that they've had a number of conversations with you over the years and that behind the scenes you're fairly sympathetic to the cause, but you didn't think you could get out in front of your caucus on the issue. Well, the House has now passed a Medicaid expansion bill by a fairly overwhelming vote, I think. Mm-hmm. You have hearings coming up in the Senate Public Health and Welfare Committee, and everybody I talk to expects that bill to shoot out of committee and arrive on the floor. And again, the folks who support expansion think that they have the votes on the floor to pass it. Now, the bill that's being debated as we speak in D.C., the replacement bill for the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, seems to expand the window for states to expand Medicaid to January of 2020. What is your prediction and what difference does that now make? Because, you know, again, opponents have been arguing that we need certainty, the situation at the federal level is so cloudy we can't move forward. Is that argument now gone?
Well, the bill not only expands access to the program till 2020, it also withdraws the federal support in 2020. So if we were to choose to expand...
Yeah, but that population that gets covered in the meantime gets that 90% going forward, but just that population.
Right, but it puts us in a situation that we have to pay then for the expansion in 2020 if that bill passes. And... I am very close to the Hospital Association. I care very much about healthcare and the quality of healthcare in Kansas and making sure that people don't have to go out of state for treatment. And when I first talked to the Hospital Association before session started, they knew we were going to have a new plan, and they said, Susan, we need to be in on the ground floor on the new plan. And we need partnership. We need a partnership because we need to engage in whatever the feds are going to come up with in a healthcare solution, which I'm willing to do. But that solution is changing. And I don't think we have the money to access those people that aren't covered and then all of a sudden pull them off in 2020. I prefer to wait till we have a plan with the Trump administration, and I think we need some legislative involvement in going forward because the healthcare feels like they're the ugly stepchild in Kansas. They feel like they've been ignored, and
well, they have actually. I mean, for 3 years they couldn't even get a bill on the floor.
That's right, they have been ignored, and we're all dependent on having facilities that are great, and we need the new drugs. And that is a large part of the Kansas community, and they feel like they're alienated. But I do believe, and I've been told this, that let's say we pass that bill and we send that waiver to the desk to maybe allow people to work, to put them in a work requirement, that it could sit there. Because what I see the feds doing is winding that program down. And while, Jim, you say that they're going to allow it for 2 years, I really don't know that they're going to allow it for 2 years because the federal government's broke too.
Right. I think you're right. I think it's either, if you're a supporter, the glass is half full. If you're an opponent, it's half empty and the water's draining out of it. Because you're right. There are some people who believe that, though, once you allow other states to get in and you have that population expanding until January 1st of 2020, what will the feds do then with virtually every state has expanded and are asking for that 90% match? Will they really then just do away with the program? I mean,
they're taking steps to that position. There's mm-hmm. no question that's where they're going, because the truth of the matter is Social Security is not breaking the federal budget. Health care is the cost of the tremendous debt of the federal government. I see them backing out. I think they want to go back to free market.
So you think what's happening at the federal level actually hurts the chances of the expansion bill here in the state?
No, I think I think that passes. I believe the bill passes on the Senate floor. I'm not sure if it's veto-proof, but it'll be close to veto-proof if it's not, because the healthcare community has become very vocal, and they want assistance. I just think the timing's wrong. And we will have a new program, and we do need a partnership with this healthcare community. And I'm just not sure what that partnership looks like.
So for you, it's a vote just to get in line, and so we have a seat at the table to negotiate whatever comes down the pipe.
Right, and I almost think that because they've been so ignored, I'd almost want some year-round legislative committee that could call the legislature back to, because I think it's going to come when we're out of session.
Mm-hmm.
That bill's going to pass when we're out of session. And I think that we need more leaders involved in that partnership from the legislature.
You know, we've opened the door to what the Trump administration is going to do, talked a little bit about transportation, a lot about health care. But I want to step back and ask you, you're one of the top three or four elected Republicans in Kansas. How do you feel about how the Trump administration is going forward? Are you uneasy with some of the things that you're seeing coming out of the White House? Do you feel in the long run that there will be a productive relationship between Kansas and the Trump administration?
Oh, I do. I kind of like that anti-establishment attitude. And, you know, he's bringing about change. And I think the people elected him because that's what they want. They want some fresh ideas. They want some new approaches. I mean, it was anger. It was darn anger that elected Trump. And they don't want things the way they used to be. They want to see an aggressive personality saying, I'm going to fix this. And that's Trump.
But being a maverick is one thing. But then accusing your predecessor on Twitter of having your phones bugged at Trump Tower with virtually no evidence to support it is entirely another thing. And it does appear that people who like what they see from Trump in terms of the moving forward, doing what he says he would do, are willing to set an awful lot of things aside for the time being. Do you think that catches up to him over time?
No, we're in a new day and age. We're in a new social media age, and people can be very outlandish on social media and say some pretty
even
wild
the
things.
President.
Even the president. But guess what? His numbers came up big after that State of the State because he was
presidential.
But then
they went back down again, though, after with the accusing of President Obama. I mean, they're up and down all the time.
We live in a new world of communication. And if anybody knows it, both Sam and Jim know it. It's, you know, and it's, you know, we are reading tweets. We're not reading books. And a short statement with colorful words has an impact, and it's catchy, and the public likes that. And they're responding to it.
I just want to say that there is room in the world for tweets and books.
Okay.
But having said that, I think what I really want to know is, are you seem to be comfortable with the Trump tweets, with the accusations that come without proof. And it's one thing, as Jim said, to say, well, I mean, maybe he is doing what he promised to do, but you're comfortable with the way he's doing it. You think he's showing the leadership that you wanted when I'm assuming that you voted for him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did vote for him.
He's leading in the way you want America led.
You know, I think that the last tweet about the tapping from Obama, clearly there's tension from the old agency heads under Obama and the new change. And it seems like there's some things that could be leaking out. And I don't know if they're true or not. You know, I think our public doesn't always take Trump literally. But you know what? We like his appointments. We like the direction he's going. And we wanted change. And so that tweet didn't bother me because maybe he had a bit of information that concerned him. And so and we don't know what's all behind it yet.
We're going to leave it there. Your candor is refreshing, and I appreciate it. Well, Jim McLean, thank you. My KCUR 89.3.
Thank you, Sam. Wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Bunky, here in our Topeka studios. Senator Wagle, thanks ever so much for being here.
I appreciate the invitation.
State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you do your podcast business. If you have the NPR One app, and if you don't, for gosh sakes, go out and get it. You can search for State House Blend Candace in Explore and then click subscribe. Twitter fans, you can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff, and my co-host Brian Ellison over there on State House Blend Missouri is at PTS Brian. I'm Sam Zeff, and I'll see you around the radio.